uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Okay, here's what's really going on. You're going to be hearing all day about, well, you know, this guy's a conservative, this guy's a, you know, he's anti-abortion, he's anti-environment, he's anti-labor, he's you know, anti-consumer. All of that is true. You know, his record is fairly straightforward. But what's really going on is that yesterday, a small story, a small Associated Press story hit the news cycle, and that's what caused George W. Bush at 9 o'clock yesterday morning to decide he had to make a decision. And at noon yesterday to call John Roberts and say, can you be at the White House tonight and schedule the announcement? And that story was the story that a memo from the State Department saying that Joe Wilson, you know, this was the day that Joe Wilson's article appeared in the New York Times back in July of 2003. And that memo from the State Department saying, number one, that Joe Wilson had written this piece, and number two, that he was right, that there was no uranium in Niger. And number three, that his wife worked with the CIA. That memo was delivered to Air Force One the day that the article appeared in the New York Times. And it was a few days later that Karl Rove began what we now refer to as Treasongate. That memo, that news story yesterday, could have been, may well be, in fact, I suspect it is. I mean, it's going to take an investigation to find out, but it could well be the hook into George W. Bush himself, that the president was involved in this treason. And if not the president, then the vice president. And frankly, I'm guessing that if it wasn't dealt with immediately by, you know, getting it out of the news cycle, that they would have thrown Colin Powell overboard. Because Colin Powell was on Air Force One. So, along with George W. Bush. Here's the story. Barry Schweid wrote this for the Associated Press. This is the big story. This is why yesterday was the day that they trotted out the Supreme Court nominee. It wasn't because Mercury goes retrograde on Friday and everybody's trying to get everything done before then. It wasn't, I mean, you know, maybe that had something to do with it. Ronald Reagan wouldn't sign documents when Mercury was retrograde, wouldn't make decisions. Could be. Although somehow you just never know. But frankly, I don't think so. You get the timeline on this thing. This was done in haste. And it wasn't because over the last 3 or 4 days, Karl Rove has been getting so much heat, because Karl Rove can handle the heat. It was because, in my opinion, it was because this thing was starting to reach all the way into the office of George W. Bush himself. This is the story. This AP story by Barry Schweid. This is the story that reveals what may be the Watergate moment for George W. Bush. And that's the reason why they had to do a series of things. Number one, he had to make a decision, which he made yesterday morning, he says at 9 o'clock in the morning, about who was going to be the nominee. Number two, they had to leak a phony name. A phony name. So that it would completely obsess the news cycle. So yesterday I'm talking about Edith Clement. Right? Because they've leaked this phony name. Why? Because they want that to be the topic. And it wasn't about hiding Karl Rove. It was about hiding George Bush. Mark my words. You'll see. Whether this gains any traction or not, now. I mean, it may be that these guys actually are going to be successful in just deep-sixing this story. Here's the story by Barry Schweid, AP diplomatic reporter. A State Department memo has caught the attention of prosecutors and describes a CIA officer's role in sending her husband to Africa and disputes administration claims that Iraq was shopping for uranium, a retired State Department official said on Tuesday. So a whistleblower has stepped forward. The article continues by Barry Schweid. The classified memo was sent to Air Force One just after former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson went public with his assertions that the Bush administration overstated the evidence that Iraq was interested in obtaining uranium from Niger for nuclear weapons. The memo has become a key piece of evidence in the CIA leak investigation because it could have been the way someone in the White House learned and then leaked the information that Wilson's wife worked for the CIA and played a role in sending him on the mission. Now, keep in mind, this document was delivered to Air Force One. The document was prepared in June 2003 at the direction of Carl W. Ford, Jr., then head of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. For Mark Grossman, the retired official said, Grossman was the Undersecretary of State who was in charge of the department while Secretary Colin Powell and his deputy, Richard Armitage, were traveling. Grossman needed the memo because he was dealing with other issues and was not familiar with the subject, the former official said. And, you know, on goes the story. Now, Powell was on his way to Africa with George W. Bush. He said, give me an update on this. This guy in his office, Carl W. Ford and Mark Grossman, these two guys in his office, they put together this memo and they send it to Air Force One. Now, one story says Colin Powell brought it with him onto Air Force One. Another says that it was transmitted to Air Force One while Colin Powell and George Bush were traveling. So now you've got the memo with Joe Wilson's wife's name in it and the fact that Joe Wilson's wife worked for the CIA. You've got that memo in the hands of George W. Bush as he's flying to Africa. And where is Karl Rove at this time? Well, the article doesn't say. My guess is Karl Rove was in Washington, D.C. In fact, this is one of the things that we're trying to track down. In fact, if any of my listeners, if you know, perhaps somebody in our chat room can help track it down. The chat room, by the way, you can get to by going to tomhartman.com and just click live chat. You can drop in there. Maybe somebody there can find out. Did Karl Rove go with George W. Bush and Colin Powell to Africa in June of 2003? If he did not, then that means that George W. Bush had to have brought this information back and given it to him, or Colin Powell did. If he was on the plane, well, again, it came through Bush. And now you see Bush, you know, trying to create all this wiggle room. Oh, yeah, I'll fire anybody who committed a crime. Right. I believe it's a crime to sign Special Form 312, which says that you will not disclose classified information, and if you have any doubts about whether something's classified, you will check before you talk to a member of the press. I believe that's a crime. We already know that that has been violated. Interesting. See, this, in my mind, this is what is the story behind the story. Now, on top of that, and in fact, you know, the State Department memo made clear that the information should not be shared. It says, you know, it just comes right out and says, you know, don't share this information with anybody. This is not information to be passed around. The Raw Story has a piece on this today. Wall Street Journal enters Rove phrase. State Department memo made clear information should not be shared. Now, this is actually out of the Wall Street Journal. News that the memo was marked for its sensitivity from the Wall Street Journal emerged as President Bush yesterday appeared to backtrack from his 2004 pledge to fire any member of his staff involved in the leaking of CIA names. I'm telling you, his rolling out the name of Mr. Roberts, John Roberts, this judge, his rolling out the judge was done not to deflect information away from the Rove treason gate scandal. It was done to deflect attention away from George W. Bush's role in treason gate. The Wall Street Journal adds, the memo's details are significant because they will make it harder for officials who saw the document to claim that they didn't realize the identity of the CIA officer was a sensitive matter. Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, may also be looking at whether other crimes such as perjury, obstruction of justice, or leaking classified information were committed. It's from the Wall Street Journal. Fascinating. Fascinating. This is the smoking gun, in my mind, that could literally bring down the administration. And then you've got, you know, Karl Rove trying to hide his alibi from the FBI. Saying, yeah, well, you know, I didn't know about it. I don't know what's going on. And then you've got the fact that Lewis Libby, Scooter Libby, Dick Cheney's assistant is involved in this thing. Well, how did Dick Cheney's assistant get the information? Well, it happened to be transmitted to Air Force One. Dick Cheney wasn't on the way to Africa with Colin Powell and George Bush. So could it be that the memo went like this? The State Department prepares a memo that says, okay, here's the story. Joe Wilson's wife works with the CIA, and there's no uranium in Niger. He's right. The memo goes to Air Force One. George W. Bush gets it. Colin Powell gets it. They read it. George W. Bush calls up Dick Cheney and tells him about it, says, hey, check this thing out, and calls up Karl Rove and says, nail this guy. Dick Cheney says to Scooter Libby, his assistant, you got to work with Rove on this thing. We're going to take this Joe Wilson guy down and anybody else in the CIA who's thinking about crossing us. And Scooter Libby in Dick Cheney's office and Karl Rove in George W. Bush's office begin telephoning reporters and cross-referencing each other. So it's not a single-source story. Now what you have is not a Treasongate crime just committed at the level of Karl Rove. What you now have is Treasongate committed at the level of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. The possibility of that coming out in the open was such a big story, such a huge potential disaster, that Bush lurched into nominating somebody for the Supreme Court, and in particular wanted to nominate somebody for the Supreme Court that he knew would create a firestorm. Why? Because that will then dominate the news cycle. So maybe he was thinking about Edith to begin with. She was a relatively moderate person. She was somebody the Democrats could do business with. But that wouldn't be a big story. That wouldn't seize the news cycle. So at 9 o'clock yesterday morning, and probably Karl Rove engineered this whole thing, frankly. 9 o'clock yesterday morning, he says, okay, it's going to be John Roberts. We're going to go with the guy with two first names, just like Clarence Thomas. It's like, what is this, radio people in the Supreme Court? Anyhow, we're going to go with this guy. He is going to dominate the news for the next few weeks. And hopefully nobody will notice that maybe the president was involved in treason. 20 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one. Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run. Yes, George, I hope you're having fun.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. 25 minutes past the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. This is another one of the extraordinary pieces of the story of Treasongate, and we're going to get into Judge Roberts as time goes on. I mean, certainly you're going to hear the whole thing on Judge Roberts on this program, and you know, there's going to be no shortage of that information. But I think that it's really important that we point out what's really going on here, and that is that not only is this a deflection gimmick, but it's a deflection gimmick away from not just Karl Rove, but in my opinion, away from George W. Bush and Dick Cheney's involvement, their complicity in Treasongate. This is that moment, like in Watergate, where everybody thought it was just the plumbers, and then they thought maybe Haldeman and Ehrlichman were in on it, and then John Dean comes and testifies before Sam Ervin's committee and says, "I told the president, sir, there's a cancer on your presidency," and everybody suddenly realizes, no, Richard Nixon was involved in this. And in that moment, everything changed. And that's that moment that George Bush is hysterically trying to prevent by throwing out a right-wing extremist as a judge so that let the wars begin. So that nobody will point out, nobody will be discussing what's actually going on with this. And one of the more amazing parts of this, which was given one paragraph by the New York Times yesterday, is Congressman Henry Waxman pointing out that as an employee of the federal government, there is a non-disclosure agreement. It's called Standard Form 312, that classified information non-disclosure agreement, Standard Form 312, that every federal employee has to sign, and it's a crime to violate the provisions of it. Karl Rove signed it, and Classified Information Non-Disclosure Agreement, Standard Form 312, says if you are not sure that the information you're disclosing is classified, check with the agency before you talk with a member of the press. And Scooter Libby in the vice president's office and Karl Rove in the president's office were both talking to the press about classified information in violation of that. And what's the penalty for this? You lose your security clearance. And so Henry Waxman is out here saying, hey, pull their security clearance, guys. Ain't happening. Ain't happening. Bush says, no, we're not going to do that, not until he's convicted of a crime. What's Bush trying to do? He's trying to push it back. He's trying to postpone it. He's trying to stay away from this thing. He's trying as much as he can not to get caught up in it, because I'm guessing he's at the center of it. Revenge on your enemies is one of the most flavorful fruits in the dinner table that George W. Bush always prepares for himself. It's the story of his life. Reward your friends, punish your enemies. George Bush has, I mean, this is the story of his life.
Either with us or against us, you're either evil or you're good.
You know, you're either with us or against it. There's no middle ground. It's absolutely all or nothing. George W. Bush.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yeah, and so he's had a good 5-year run of being that dictator. And now it may be threatened. As Treasongate moves from Karl Rove toward George W. Bush himself. And we'll see. Will John Roberts blow that off the front pages for a few days? I suspect so, but maybe not. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, on radio stations in California to Pennsylvania, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on the web at radiopower.org and whiterosesociety.org. Apple's iTunes, iPodcasting. Welcome back to our program. At the same time, another one of the things that the Bush administration would like us to forget about, one of the reasons, in my opinion, why they rolled out Judge John Roberts with the haste that George Bush did. And this absolute panic that descended on the White House yesterday when the AP came out with the story that the State Department memo that noted that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA first went to Air Force One and to George W. Bush before Karl Rove started leaking the information, possibly implicating George Bush in Treasongate. I mean, that's one of the things they don't want us to know about, one of the things they want us to forget about. Obviously, Karl Rove's troubles, they'd rather we forgot about. They also don't want us to know or, you know, be discussing the fact that the economy's in the toilet. Remember when George W. Bush first came out with his voodoo economics and he says, hey, we've got no problem here. I got everything, you know, all fixed up for you. We'll take care of it. All we got to do is give tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires. It's going to solve all problems. In fact, if we give a tax cut equal to $500,000 to some millionaire or billionaire, they'll create one job. Remember that?
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief. We will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
That's right. 1 million jobs divided into $550 billion is $500,000 per job. I'm telling you, if they just picked out 1 million people in the United States and gave each one of them $500,000, you would see an economic boom, particularly if it was middle class folks. You'd see an economic boom, bang, just like that, because those people would start spending the money. Anyhow, Greg LeRoy has done a great job of exposing, this whole the Great American Jobs Scam is what he calls it, the title of his book, The Great American Jobs Scam, Corporate Tax Dodging, and the Myth of Job Creation. And we have to keep on the economics of this thing with a foreword by William Grider, by the way, as well as all the other crimes of this administration. I think their economic crimes are perhaps the worst because their economic crimes, in my opinion, are the reason why they're committing all these other crimes so that they can continue to get rich and control power. Greg, welcome to the program. Oh, we have lost Greg. Scott, you're going to have to call Greg back. I don't know what's happened here. I think our phones are flaky. Anyhow, so we'll move along on that one. Boom, vanished right off the screen. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, our chat room. George W. Bush and his taxes. Scott, we've lost Greg. You got to do something about that. Anyway, I want to get back to this this thing with this Judge John Roberts. What's up with Judge John Roberts? First of all, just a quick snapshot. I just have to give you a snapshot. Who is John Roberts and what's he all about? A quick summary, okay? He worked for Ken Starr. Yeah, he worked for this guy when he was working for Ken Starr. Was when he first came, the Reagan administration had passed this law that said that if you get any federal money at all, you cannot, and you're working in the field of reproductive rights, you're helping folks out, if you get any federal money at all, you cannot tell women that abortion even exists. He's working for Ken Starr, and Ken Starr says, okay, let's use that as a hook to flip Roe v. Wade in an argument before the Supreme Court. And he sends John Roberts in to argue it. And John Roberts goes before the Supreme Court and says, you know, it looks to us like Roe v. Wade was not appropriately decided. That's, point one. We'll continue through him as the program goes on. We got Greg back on the phone. Greg LeRoy. Greg, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thanks very much, Tom.
I don't, you vanished there a few minutes ago. I don't know how much you heard of my intro of you.
I didn't hear any, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, we were talking about George W. Bush and his tax scam. Suppose you're a manufacturing executive. You say in your book here, and you don't like paying corporate income tax. How'd you like to get a 90%, 80 or 90% tax cut, no conditions, no strings attached? How do you do that?
Well, you just get your state manufacturers association to lobby for a magical.
Greg, I think we've lost you. To lobby for a magical
formula called single sales factor, where instead of using three different ways to determine how much of your income would be taxable in a given state, you just boil it down to one, and usually that's the smallest factor. factor, that is sales, how much of your sales occur in a state. And if the state that you are based in, that you have your headquarters in and most of your, you know, factories and warehouses in, you could get an 80 or 90% cut just by filing your income taxes with no requirements about creating or retaining any jobs.
Yeah. John, my recollection is that 30, 40, 50 years ago, roughly half of the income taxes in the United States, half of the cost of the commons was paid for by the business community, which uses about half of the commons. They use our educated workforce. They use our rights of way. They use our highways. They use our water, our police protections, our fire protections, and things like this. And now it's dropped somewhat from that. Do you have those numbers right offhand?
Well, there's different ways that the data gets sliced and diced. Certainly at the state levels, corporate income taxes alone often presented, you know, a fourth or a fifth or a sixth of the income tax base. In many states now, they're into low single-digit percentages.
Yeah, here in Oregon, for example, just in the last 10 years, it's gone from 16% to 6% or 5%.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very typical story.
Yeah, so subsidizing sprawl, subsidizing Walmart. How do taxpayers subsidize Walmart?
Well, they subsidize it both in the front door and in the back door. In the front door, we've identified more than $1 billion of bricks and mortar subsidies given to the company or to developers building their stores for land and loans and tax credits and training grants and enterprise zones. That's the front door, like I say, bricks and mortar subsidies. And then in the back door, taxpayers subsidize it through social safety net programs like Medicaid and children's health insurance and free school lunches and housing assistance. Because so many of the company's employees get paid so little, they qualify for poverty safety net programs.
Yeah, this is the other thing that people don't get, is they say, oh, you know, you're just supporting people on welfare. Well, actually, those people on welfare are working at Walmart. And without the welfare, they wouldn't, you know, their kids would have no medical care.
In 14 states have now divulged company-specific data about Medicaid or children's health insurance, and Walmart is consistently the highest ranked of the companies. Obviously, you get the other fast food chains and temp agencies in there as well.
What percentage of the people who are using social services are actually the working poor as opposed to the, you know, Ronald Reagan's welfare queens stereotype, people who are professionally on welfare?
Oh, well, overwhelmingly. I'm not sure I could put an aggregate percentage blanket across all the programs, but most people don't forget that food stamps, the earned income tax credit, Medicaid, are either exclusively designed for people working, like the earned income tax credit, or people who are simply making low wages and have lousy benefits and therefore need health care or need other benefits to scrape by.
Yeah. Loot, loot, loot for the home team. How did George Bush become a millionaire?
Well, that's people forget the largest source of his individual wealth was when he and a group of investors flipped the Texas Rangers after winning a taxpayer subsidy to build a new stadium for the Texas Rangers.
Which was forced on the people of Arlington, Texas by the use of eminent domain.
Yeah, eminent domain was involved, as well as a referendum to raise the sales tax. A regressive consumption tax funded the deal. And then they got a bunch of land along with the land for the stadium. They also got given a bunch of land to develop with their profit as well. And like other franchise owners, the real money to be made was not so much in operating the franchise, but in selling it, especially after getting a big taxpayer-financed stadium, which greatly enhanced the value of the franchise.
Wow. And now, from shifting from national statistics and from individual states, over the past 25 years, corporations, especially big ones, are getting lower tax rates and paying a smaller share of the cost for public services, shifting the burden on everybody else, shifting the burden. This goes just beyond the old saw of internalized profits, externalized costs.
Yeah, this really has to do with rewriting entire corporate income tax codes and granting subsidies that are so lavish that companies actually don't pay any income taxes for years on some of their new investments. There's actually an embryonic industry now in the selling and buying of economic development tax credits. That's now legal in four states at least because companies have so many of them they don't know what to do with them. That's how out of control these things have gotten.
We're talking with Greg Leroy, the author of The Great American Job Scam, Corporate Tax Dodging and the Myth of Job Creation. Greg, you identify some specific scams that are out there. This is like, you know, three-card money, the pigeon drop, you know, whatever. And for example, tell us how some of these work. Job blackmail, how does that work?
Well, job blackmail. sure. It's epidemic in New York City, but hardly confined to there. When companies threaten to leave, if you've got a dominant employer like a Raytheon in Massachusetts, a Conagra in Nebraska, a New York Stock Exchange in New York City, they go to the mayor or the governor and they say, you know, if you don't give us a big tax break or rewrite your tax code in a way that favors our company or our industry, we could be out of here. And we've got mayors and governors willing to go have lunch and stage, you know, PR events with us talking about how they'd love to have us move across the river or down the street to their jurisdiction and get a big subsidy package from them.
Greg Leroy, can you imagine what would happen if you or I, or even if we got together, were to show up at the office of the mayor and say, if you don't give me a tax break, I'm going to leave town?
Well, and that's the glaring hypocrisy of all this.
Laugh us out of their office.
Yeah, yeah. And think about the school situation, for instance. Lots of people move into higher tax areas to get access to better public schools during the years that their kids are in school. They accept higher housing prices. They accept higher property taxes. Companies do that, too. They want to move into areas with good schools to help attract good employers and get high-skilled workers. But they often get 10-year tax holidays paying no property taxes for moving into their preferred area.
So, another scam here is called Take the Money and Run. Sykes Company?
Yeah, Sykes Company is a company based in Tampa. It's a call center company. We identified more than a dozen subsidized facilities, mostly little farm towns, including Oregon and the Plain States in the Northwest, where they'd gotten, you know, multiple subsidies to open call centers, often employing 400 or 500 people, but then closing them. At the same time, the company grew its workforce in the Philippines and Costa Rica.
So how do they make money on this, opening a call center and then closing it and moving to the Philippines?
Well, obviously, they make a big windfall on their labor costs when they move the jobs overseas, and they are often deeded the land.
I get it. So they come in and they say, we'll bring 400 jobs to your community. Give us a bunch of land. The community gives them the land. Then they dump the jobs to the Philippines, but they've still got the land.
Well, and other, you know, sometimes there's cash grants involved. Sometimes there's cheap loans. There's training grants that reduce the cost of the wages they pay in the little farm town. All that stuff goes to their bottom line during the time they're operating the facility, and we couldn't find evidence that they had to pay any of it back.
Amazing. Here's another one. Payoffs for layoffs. Bank of America and IBM. Payoffs for layoffs? Another one of these scams?
Yeah. New York City has been shaken down many times by companies, including Bank of America. And we read the fine print of the contracts and found that in many cases, the contracts were written so loose that it gave the company lots of latitude to lay many people off before triggering any kind of penalties or allowing them to avoid penalties at all. We also found a kind of extreme perverse case of IBM laying off a bunch of people in the Hudson Valley in upstate New York, triggering a change in a so-called enterprise zone law there, which allowed them to come back later and get huge tax credits for a microchip plant, even though the area was not depressed at all. It had just been declared an enterprise zone because IBM had laid off a gazillion people there about 7 years before.
So they're in an area, they're doing well, they shut down their factory there, that throws the area into a recession. Then they come back into the area and say, the area's in a recession, you can now give us a big grant?
Yep. Well, in so many words, that's what IBM did in upstate New York.
Okay. Another scam.
New York.
Another scam is called Exploit the War Among the States.
I cite the case of Illinois over-subsidizing, in my opinion, one of the first Japanese auto transplants, the assembly plant, a company called Diamond Star that located in Bloomington, Illinois, got a subsidy worth about $250 million in 1985. Even though it was common knowledge among auto people in the country at that time that Japan was eagerly locating facilities in Midwestern industrial states with a lot of union members as a way to deflect protectionist legislation, because the U.S. House had passed legislation requiring domestic content in 83, and the Japanese were eager to deflect that move. So even though everybody knew that in the industry, Big Jim Thompson, the governor of Illinois then, accepted the idea that maybe they would go to Indiana, maybe they would go to Michigan, maybe they would go to Iowa instead, and gave them this huge package.
And this is, I remember when Boeing did this, when they were shopping around for new headquarters, playing one community off it against the other.
A very public auction they conducted between Dallas, Denver, and Chicago, winning a package more than $40 million from the city of Chicago and Illinois. In an episode that we think really demonstrates a very, very dubious cost-benefit claims made by the state of Illinois.
How do governments, we have about a minute left here, we're talking to Greg Leroy, the author of Job Scam. How do governments deal with this? What can we the people do to stop this kind of ripoff?
A couple really fundamental things. Disclosures. 12 states now have some form of annual company-specific reporting of costs and benefits so the taxpayers can get in there and root out the bad deals. Clawbacks, money-back guarantee language, saying if you don't deliver on the 100 jobs, if you only created 50, we get half our money back. Job quality standards, saying we're not going to subsidize poverty wage jobs anymore, like Walmart jobs, where people are still eligible for food stamps and Medicaid. If every state enacted those reforms across the board, things would be very different.
And what do you think the chances are of every state doing that? I'm assuming that this is the kind of thing that the Democrats are in favor of, and the kind of reforms that the Democrats support and the Republicans ferociously oppose.
You know, the problem is pretty bipartisan, actually. If you put the D's and R's after the villains in my book, there'd be a lot in both parties.
Yeah.
And there've actually been, although I would say there's been more D's behind some of the reforms. Certainly, there've been some R's, even tripartisan in the case of Minnesota. The last two times they passed reforms there.
That's great. So there's some hope.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Greg Leroy, The Great American Job Scam. Is there a website, Greg?
www.goodjobsfirst, all one word and first is spelled out, .org.
Great, goodjobsfirst.org. Greg Leroy, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour. We're going to get back to the judge right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. John Roberts, the judge who said that a 12-year-old could and should be locked up, dragged off in handcuffs, locked into a cell for eating a single French fry on the Washington, D.C. subway system, that was the metro system, that was just fine. Who ruled that the folks in the U.S. concentration camps at Guantanamo Bay have no rights under the Geneva Convention, neither should they have access to the U.S. civilian court system. The fascist candidate, the lead fascist candidate among the bunch, him and Alberto Gonzalez, John Roberts has been trotted out, and I'm telling you, the reason why is to deflect attention away from the fact that George W. Bush and or Dick Cheney may have been involved in Treasongate. I've shared earlier with you in the program the story from the Associated Press yesterday that, in my opinion, is the thing that made George Bush panic. Here's the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington yesterday also issued this news release. Long before the Karl Rove scandal grew into today's political maelstrom, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington sent a letter to President Bush on January 28, 2004, asking that he call upon the White House counsel to investigate Vice President Cheney's confirmation of leaked classified information in an interview with the Rocky Mountain News on January 9, 2004. As of today, no such investigation has taken place. Federal law prohibits leaking classified information. And they talk about the non-disclosure form and all that kind of thing. On a January 9th, 2004 interview, Cheney referred to a story that appeared in the Weekly Standard's November 24, 2003 issue that discussed a Defense Department memo, which included a list of CIA, NSA, and Defense Intelligence Agency raw reports regarding possible links between al-Qaeda and Iraq. Cheney, responding to a question regarding the relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda, called the Standard story, quote, the best information out there, end quote. Which somewhat disagreed with the Pentagon's press release of November 15th, saying that the information was inaccurate, deplorable, and maybe illegal. Yes, those are verbatim quotes from the Pentagon. The Pentagon also stated that leaking such information, quote, does serious harm to national security, end quote. But Dick Cheney, he's out there corroborating the leak. Dick Cheney. In fact, this group crew says today White House officials are simply not abiding by federal law. Yeah, not abiding by federal law. Gee, I wonder why. It's could it have something to do with...
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
We'll let you decide. I'm Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or Fox News.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast. This is one of those issues that I think transcends, absolutely transcends left-right issues. It's not a partisan issue. The issue of whether the government has the right and the power or the necessity to allow, to facilitate the transfer of our private property to the owners of other private property. That is, from one non-governmental entity to another non-governmental. You know, we all agree that there is some need for eminent domain, as identified in the Fifth Amendment. As I recall, it's the Fifth Amendment. Is that right, Greg Bergdahl?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. We have with us, by the way, Bert Gall, staff attorney for the Institute for Justice. I think we all agree that there's a need for things like schools and roads and fire stations and police departments, and that the land, you can't just make it out of nothing, and so occasionally eminent domain is a necessary thing, and it's appropriate that people be compensated. But how did the Supreme Court, and I think this is a good day to discuss this, given what happened yesterday with George Bush trying to change the subject away from treason gate by throwing out this John Roberts guy. How did the Supreme Court come to conclude that it's an appropriate thing that a municipality, a county, a state, federal government for that matter, can take property from you and me and give it to another private for-profit entity?
Well, I mean, there has been a gradual erosion of your rights under the Fifth Amendment for a long time now. And what happened in the Kelo case, the recently decided Supreme Court case, was a culmination of that. Because the Fifth Amendment literally says property can only be taken for a public use. And what you said before is right. Things like a bridge or a road or a courthouse, something that the public will literally, own and use. It was never intended to be used so that Donald Trump could build, condominiums, or someone could build a shopping center or a Costco or a Walmart. But over the past 50 years, municipalities have been really aggressive and really stretching the limits of eminent domain.
In fact, this is how George W. Bush became a millionaire.
Well, it first started back in the 1950s. Actually from Washington, in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. in a case called Berman versus Parker, where, there were, slum conditions, and we're talking about really bad slum conditions, in an area of D.C. where, the city government wanted to condemn and transfer the land to private developers. And at that point, the court said, okay, we're gonna make a narrow exception here because the slums are so bad, getting rid of them would serve a public purpose.
Even if the getting rid of is done by a private developer, you mean?
Right. But the court started talking about purpose, public purpose instead of public use. And so the door was left slightly ajar.
That was the camel's nose under the edge of the tent.
Exactly. And over the next 50 years, what you saw municipalities start to do was condemn property not only in slums, but then in really nice areas. And in fact, you really have these absurd situations where municipalities were trying to say that, normal neighborhoods or just, neighborhoods were blight or slum based on the most ridiculous, circumstances. In one case that I litigated up in Lakewood, Ohio, near Cleveland, a city tried to claim that a neighborhood was blighted because it didn't have things, some of the neighborhood homes didn't have things like two full bathrooms or three full bedrooms or an attached two-car garage. So you got this, this ridiculous definition of blight. And then it culminated in the Kelo versus City of New London case, where there the city didn't claim that there was anything physically wrong with the homes or businesses at all. It just said, well, if we give it to a developer, they'll create more tax dollars, they'll create more jobs, and so that's good enough. And that's the logic that the Supreme Court went along with, and the majority did in their 5-4 decision.
Why?
Well, unfortunately, there is a real tendency in a lot of courts to give entirely too much deference to the decisions of, you know, local politicians or just politicians in general, to say, you know what, if they've decided in the, through the democratic process that it's good enough to give property from A to B so that B can make more money, then we're going to step back. And I mean,
yeah,
your
seems,
question.
You know, it seems to me, pardon my interrupting, Bert Gall, but it seems that that is the logic of essentially the anti-federalists, the folks who would say, you know, traditionally the anti-federalists, the folks who today call themselves states' writers, to some extent, who would say, well, you know, if the local the best politics is local politics, and the worst politics is national politics, and, you know, the most disconnected from the people, and so the court should do everything it can to empower the local politicians and diminish the power at the national level. And that seems like that would be, you know, if that's the case, then it seems like Scalia and Thomas and Rehnquist should have lined up in favor of Kelo, and the so-called liberals on the court should have been against it, and it flipped the other way. I don't understand how that happened.
Well, because, you know, federalism, you know, only goes so far, because, I mean, the Constitution provides a baseline protection of all of our rights. And states, while they are certainly free to give you more protection than, say, under the First Amendment or the Fifth Amendment or the Fourth Amendment than the federal Constitution provides, they can't go beneath that basic floor. And on at least on that, there is a real level of agreement kind of throughout the ideological spectrum. The real debate then centers on, well, what does public use, you know, actually mean? If we know that it applies some basic protection to everyone throughout the states, and I guess what makes the majority's decision so baffling, you know, to me, is that can you ever imagine the Supreme Court saying something like, let's say one state, you know, passes some draconian law against freedom of the press? Can you ever imagine the Supreme Court saying, okay, we're going to leave it to Missouri to determine how, you know, First Amendment freedom should be protected?
Right.
You know, we're not going to step in here and do this. And I think Justice O'Connor was exactly right. She was, in her dissent, she said, you know, this isn't federalism. This is a basic abdication of the court's role to protect basic constitutional rights when they're threatened. And I really think, I mean, you know, Justice O'Connor went out with a bang and a flourish, you know, in that dissenting opinion. I think she was exactly right.
Yeah, it's really a tragedy, frankly, because it opens the door for people to think, number one, that this was something that would be supported by liberals. And I don't know anybody, liberal or progressive, who supports the Kelo decision. They haven't run across one so far.
Well, the only people you'll find who support it are going to be big developers,
right,
and a lot of municipal officials who have done this or want to do this in the future.
Right.
But that's basically it. I mean, normal Americans, everyone else, thinks this decision is outrageous.
So you're trying to get this before the Supreme Court to rehear the case?
Yes. On Monday, we filed a motion for rehearing, and we're the first to admit that the chances of success on that are very small. The court very rarely grants rehearing on anything.
Mm-hmm.
But we at least wanted to demonstrate to the court that the floodgates are literally opening all over the country now. A lot of developers and cities were kind of sitting back and waiting to see what happened in Kelo. But literally within hours of the Kelo decision, municipalities were filing condemnation actions to transfer land to developers. And literally, we've seen, you know, several instances of this going on. So we wanted to remind the court that this is no hypothetical parade of horribles that we're talking about here. This is an actual parade of horribles. This kind of abuse happens all over the country all the time. And in the wake of their decision, it's only going to get worse, not better.
What makes you think the court might reverse itself?
Well, I mean, like I said, our chances of success, I think, on the motion for rehearing are not very good, just because in general, the court rarely, if ever, decides to grant it. But
now, the complexion of the court has changed. Was Kelo a 5-4 decision?
Kelo was a 5-4 decision.
Okay, so although Justice O'Connor was opposed to it, and so she's been
right,
replaced by John Roberts, who presumably would also be opposed to it.
Presumably, but you know, Justice O'Connor is still a member of the court until you know, any confirmation, and it's not even clear whether newly appointed Justice Roberts would even be able to participate in the rehearing. But so, but we, you know, it was at least important to follow through with the court and say, look, this is the real world, mm-hmm. and your decision is affecting, you know, real people throughout the country. You know, most times when a Supreme Court decision comes out, you know, people say, oh, you know, here's something that affected a very kind of narrow group of people or a narrow issue. But this issue, like, affects everybody.
What can people do about this?
Well, there's a lot of things people, you know, can do. The silver lining of the court's opinion, if there is one, is that it at least recognized that states can provide greater protection. I mean, the court didn't do its job in providing enough protection under the Fifth Amendment, but state courts and state legislatures.
We now have 12 states who are passing laws in response to this, don't we?
We've got, you know, the number of states I think that is at least considering this kind of legislation is over 20 now.
It is.
I think maybe close to 25.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you see these opinion polls that come out, these flash polls that came out after Kelo, showing like, you know, 96 and higher percentage of people opposed to the decision, politicians understand that.
Right.
You know, that they understand that there's a real, you know, groundswell of opposition here against this. So, yeah, several states are considering legislation that would forbid the use of eminent domain for private development. And we encourage, you know, we encourage people to contact their state legislators and say, you know, look, this is something that needs to be done. It shouldn't be open season on my home or my small business just because some fat cat down the street wants it for himself. So that's one thing that people can do. And people need to watch out, you know, behind the scenes at their city council. If they start hearing a rumbling that their city council is about to, you know, engage in a big land grab for somebody else, you got to start making noise now more than ever, you know, with these politicians and really kind of shine the light on a lot of these backroom dealings. And also, you know, there are several states out there where the state Supreme Courts have already said that under their state constitution, you cannot use eminent domain for economic development. You know, Michigan has recently said this. Illinois has said this. South Carolina has said this. And a few others have said this as well. And so, you know, if the United States Supreme Court justices aren't going to do their job and protect your basic rights, it's up to state Supreme Courts to do that.
What's to prevent, we just have a few seconds left, but what's to prevent a, you know, if a state passes a law, a developer from saying, hey, you know, the Supreme Court has already decided in our favor, your law is unconstitutional?
Absolutely not. The Supreme Court said that you can provide more protection than they provided in their opinion. So,
oh, I see.
Any developer.
So they put an escape hatch into the decision.
They said, you know, basically we've set the baseline here, but states are free to do more, but states have to do more, and frankly, the court should have taken care of it, you know, under the plain language of the Fifth Amendment and provided a national high baseline of protection. But since they failed, it's up to state legislators and it's up to state courts.
And your website is ij.org.
That's correct.
www.ij.org. People can find out more information about this. Bert Gaul, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. Good to get the inside scoop on all of this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 20 minutes past the hour.
The Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Your cheating heart.
George.
Will make you weak.
We've discovered, George, that you might be the source of the Treason Gate leak. Or maybe it's Dick. So George is going to have a conversation with Dick, and we'll find out what's going on, maybe. But the AP now saying that could be that the State Department memo outing Valerie Plame actually went to Air Force One first, What's that all about? Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, yes, I have also been reading that the State Department memo did go to Air Force One because the members of the administration, Colin Powell and others, were heading off on this trip.
To Africa, yeah.
Right.
I'm trying to find out if Karl Rove was on that plane.
I don't know the answer to that. But I think in terms of whether he knew the contents of the memo or not, it could matter or it could not matter. If so many people had access to it and everybody was talking about it, and I understand that it, you know, it's pretty small space on a plane, somebody could have overheard and told him.
It told Karl Rove.
Right.
Somebody like George W. Bush?
Somebody like George W. Bush or somebody like Ari Fleischer or anybody else.
Yeah, don't you find it odd, though, that the memo goes to Colin Powell and George Bush? And then George Bush's assistant Karl Rove and Dick Cheney's assistant Scooter Libby start dialing for dollars. They start calling up reporters to leak this information. First of all, the memo makes it clear that the information is secret, that it's not to be leaked. Secondly, these guys all signed this form, 132 or 123, whatever it is, that says that you can't do that. And so they at the very least have to lose their security clearances. And it's just, and third, my take on this is that yesterday when that story came out, that was the moment at which George W. Bush realized that the scandal might rise all the way to him. That was that John Dean testifies moment.
Which story?
The Treasongate story.
No, when which bit of it came out?
When the Associated Press reported that the State Department memo, the first time that anybody knew that Valerie Plame was Joe Wilson's wife and worked at the CIA and might have had something to do with Niger,
right,
was when that memo went to Air Force One.
Right.
And, you know, in Watergate, there was that moment where John Dean testified before the Senate, you know, or the House Select Committee on Investigation, whichever committee it was, and said, and I went to the president. And in that moment, all of America suddenly got the, oh, my God. And everybody realized, and everybody in the House and Senate realized, Richard Nixon was in on this. And
yes,
that was the turning point. And I think that yesterday was the turning point. I think that was the point that, you know, had it gotten traction. And that's why Bush had to so quickly come out with John Roberts.
Well, it is interesting that he apparently, you know, made the decision sometime, I don't know, during the morning yesterday, because earlier in the day at the availability, the press availability with John Howard of Australia that I attended, he seemed to be making it clear, and of course he was kind of obtuse in his answer to the question, that he was further along than he was the previous day, but he did not state that he had decided. In fact, he did everything he could to deflect people.
Yeah.
Now, Karl Rove still seems to be saying, at least through surrogates, that calls were made to him rather than that he was making calls to people.
Yeah, well, it may be that Scooter Libby was calling people and saying, here's the scoop, and if you don't believe me, call Karl Rove and ask him.
Well, the Scooter Libby connection is very interesting, very interesting. I asked back in October 2003 about Scooter Libby. In the same question they asked about Karl Rove and Elliot Abrams.
This was of Ari Fleischer?
Yeah, no, this was of Scott McClellan.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This was the question that asked whether any of them had told any reporter that that Joseph Wilson's wife worked for the CIA.
And McClellan said no.
McClellan said he'd spoken to them. And they'd assured him that...
That was your question?
That was my question.
Oh, I'm impressed. I know the person who asked the question that's got everybody all freaked out.
Oh, yeah. No, my question...
good on you, Victoria.
My question's the one in the middle of it. I'm waiting for the horse's head on the pillow today.
Well,
So he assured us that he had spoken with Scooter Libby.
Yeah, amazing. Well, we'll see where it goes. Thanks for keeping us in the loop, keeping us up to date.
Thank you.
Okay, have a good one. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Jose Padilla's lawyer, or Padilla, he's asked to be called Jose Padilla, his lawyer saying, please charge my client with a crime. More in just a minute.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And here on Bloomberg.com, a report that Bob Novak called Ari Fleischer the day that the State Department memo was prepared and sent to Air Force One. Ari, of course, was on Air Force One with the president and with George W. Bush and with Colin Powell. And that we don't know if Ari Fleischer returned Bob Novak's call or not. But interesting. The story thickens. 3 days after that, on July 11th, Rove also discussed Wilson with his wife with Time magazine reporter Matthew Cooper. Cooper said, and on it goes. We'll see where this goes. We'll see where this goes. With regard to John Roberts, I get an email here from Chad in Salem, Oregon. He says, were you expecting a moderate to liberal nomination from George W. Bush? Last November, the American people spoke and voted to keep this president. Well, that's a nice hypothesis. I'm not sure that it's true. In fact, I don't believe that it's true. I believe the exit polls. Just like the people in the Ukraine, just like the people in Serbia, just like the people in Soviet Georgia believed the exit polls, I believe the exit polls. I am convinced that our voting system in this country has become so corrupted, in particular by the last 6 years of attacks upon it largely by Republicans, that it can't be trusted. So, number one, he says, last November, the American people spoke and voted to keep us president. I believe the exit polls that George Bush lost by 3 million votes, and not that he won by 2 million votes, that the electronic voting machines tell us. And then he goes on to say, when you vote for a president, you're also indirectly voting for how the United States Supreme Court will look. This country, by reelecting Bush, made its voice clear in how they want the laws and policies of the USA to be. Personally, I don't agree with the way this administration is running things, but the majority spoke last November. Sincerely, Chad in Salem, Oregon. Well, you know, nice sentiment, Chad. Here's the thing. This is the big lie, and here we have a listener already beginning to echo the big lie that the Bushies are going to be putting out. And I guarantee you this big lie is going to be all over the talk shows today. One of the major Republican talking points. When Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a liberal, came before the United States Senate, when Bill Clinton was president, the Republican senators voted for her, gave her a nice, polite hearing, voted for her, allowed her to have a seat on the Supreme Court. Now it's time. Now you have a conservative president. He's nominated a conservative justice. It's time for his nominee to go onto the court. That's what they're going to say. And it sounds nice on the surface. It seems to make a certain amount of sense. The problem is twofold. Number one, it's based on a lie. The reason that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is on the court is because Republican Senator Orrin Hatch called up Bill Clinton and said, I have a recommendation for you. If you nominate Ruth Bader Ginsburg, we Republicans will support her. So the nomination did not come from Clinton. The nomination came from Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, number one. Now, you certainly can't say that of John Roberts. No Democrat would have put forward this guy. A guy who says that Roe v. Wade should be repealed, essentially. In fact, tries to repeal it when he's working, a guy who worked for Ken Starr. A guy who doesn't believe that the federal government should have any role in protecting endangered species. Because endangered species can't do business, so they're not covered by the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. A guy who thinks it's just fine that the government not have the power to protect an endangered species, but does have the power to take a 12-year-old girl in Washington, D.C., and arrest her, drag her off in handcuffs, throw her in a jail cell, take her shoelaces so she won't commit suicide, and throw her in a jail for eating one French fry on the Washington, D.C. subway. A guy it just goes on and on and on and on. And this is not the kind of candidate that the Democrats would have put forward. I mean, there are conservatives, there are Republicans that the Democrats would have said, okay, fine. That person is a true conservative Republican. This guy is not a conservative. This guy is a radical. He's a Federalist. He's a radical. John G. Roberts, Jr., a radical. So, you know, what do you do? What are you going to do? 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Laura in Arcata, California on the line. Hey, Laura, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was just listening to you, and your last few words really made my stomach sink. But anyway, I was listening earlier, and you were talking about Karl Rove and Bush and Treasongate, mm-hmm. and I wanted to call because I'm married to a Republican, and whenever I try to talk to him about this issue, he says, well, it's not even on the media anymore. It's dropped. It's not an issue. And I just feel at a total loss. I don't have the equipment and the you know, background knowledge to support my arguments. And I'm just amazed that, you know, CNN's not talking about it anymore.
You're talking about Treasongate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what they're doing today, but I didn't hear anything about it yesterday. And the day before, you know, it's like Rove's name has disappeared from the mainstream.
And Scooter Libby and Bush and Cheney, the whole bunch of them. Laura, do you have an internet connection?
Do I what?
Are you connected?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I would, you know, I would suggest that you put on your daily list to check out buzzflash.com and commondreams.org.
Buzzflash.com?
Right, and commondreams.org.
Okay.
And opednews.com is also a good site. And, I mean, there's a bunch of them, but those are among my personal favorites. You'll find there the links to the stories that are being ignored or that are being buried or that they're right there hiding in plain sight. That, you know, are not being discussed on the mainstream media by and large.
Okay, well, I just pulled over. I'm in a car, so I have to write this down.
Okay, always good to pull over.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So can you please say that one more time?
Sure, and for our listeners at home as well, buzzflash.com, BUZZFLASH, buzzflash.com, and Common Dreams, all one word, commondreams.org.
Thank you.
And I mean, there's a bunch of other ones out there, too. The Smirking Chimp, I believe it's .com. The TV Truth and Lies, I believe it's .org. In fact, we have a lot of these folks on Friday afternoons in our Best of the Rest of News segment. Alternet.org is an excellent site. TomPaine.com, an excellent site. I mean, there's a number of good websites. There is a certain level of redundancy because, you know, they're certain minimum number of stories that they're pointing to, and
mm-hmm.
Those are the two that I find the most useful. But I also you know check out the other ones as well. So
that's Buzzflash or
Buzzflash FLASH.
Oh great, okay. Well, thank you so much for that information.
Sure
I really
enough.
Appreciate it, and I also want you to know how much I appreciate listening to you. It's really soothing to hear your voice and your information, and the way you put it together is really like a voice in the wilderness. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Laura. I appreciate your kind words. Thank you for listening. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Listening on, I believe it's KGOE there in Arcata, California. Nick, on listening on WPTT in Pennsylvania, I believe. Hey, Nick.
Hi. With all the events here unfolding at a pace that they are, there's kind of an overwhelming something that's becoming more and more obvious. And I want to, this morning, you know, you started right in, and if anything really needs to be attacked on a daily basis, for my feeling, my own personal feelings, it is the level and the degree of hypocrisy and corruption here.
Yeah.
I can take politics, you know, or business as usual, but we've gone way beyond, you know. If this is business as usual, and if this is what anybody in anywhere, I guess, right now is espousing as, you know, capitalism, the virtues of capitalism, or the virtues of this or that or whatever, okay? You know, what is that? What is it? What are they really saying, and how do they really expect people to accept this, you know? Because if this is capitalism, if this is conservatism, if this is the neocon, or the neocon agenda, or the neocon world, or the new world order, I mean, they must be really crazy to think that we're going to just go along for the ride here.
Well, I think that, number one, I don't think that they're crazy. Number two, I mean, you've got people who are serious ideologues. They actually believe in this dystopian philosophy. They believe that the world will be a better place I mean, these, we're not talking people who are, by and large, who are intentionally evil or sociopathic. I think that there may be some exceptions to that, and there are the folks, the psychiatrists who are concerned about George W. Bush concern me. But by and large, I think most of the people who call themselves conservatives, are not bad people. They're good people, and they think that they're reaching the best goals. But if you look at history, you see that there's the techniques that they're using to get there, of turning the control of the commons over to private for-profit corporations and surrendering our civil liberties, don't accomplish a positive outcome. You end up wiping out the middle class, and you end up with fascism essentially in the United States.
I agree with all of them too, but I think at a point, even these people, if that's the case, and all things being fair and equal, okay, I think that they have to stand up sooner or later. They too have to capitulate here and say, okay, we understand we have politics, we have to live with the left, we have to live with the right, we have to live with all the flaws in the systems and all the inherent things that go wrong.
Well, that's how Republicans traditionally responded, and starting with Lee Atwater and Ronald Reagan, they said, no, we're going to start playing dirty politics. And Lee Atwater's main student, of course, was Karl Rove. And Lee Atwater, on his deathbed, apologized for the kind of politics he'd been playing. The Willie Horton ads against Michael Dukakis and all this other stuff. But Karl Rove not only would never apologize for it, he's quite proud of it. And it, which brings again to mind the word sociopath. But nonetheless, that's what we've got. Nick, I got to move along, but thanks for the call. Good point you make, and I appreciate it. This John G. Roberts, 50 years old. He's going to be 30 years more or less on the Supreme Court if he is appointed. And this guy is really and truly, first of all, really and truly dangerous. He was a member of the Lawyers for Bush Cheney in the 2000 election. The law firm that he worked for was one of the law firms that helped litigate Bush v. Gore when George Bush sued Al Gore to stop the count in Florida. The Supreme Court case that handed the presidency to George W. Bush in 2000, even though Al Gore got more votes in Florida than George Bush did, and even though Al Gore got more votes everywhere in the United States than George Bush did. Now, of course, we didn't know that Al Gore got more votes than Bush in Florida until a year later, when they were all counted. And it was published in the New York Times and in the Washington Post. By any measure, pregnant Chads, dimpled Chads, intent of voter, not intent, by any measure, no matter how you counted it, no matter how you looked at it, Al Gore won the election. But he's not president. And this guy, John Roberts, his law firm was involved in that litigation. And then he went to work for Ken Starr. Working for Ken Starr, the Republicans passed this law saying that if you're getting federal money and you're running any kind of an educational program at all, and if federal money is coming into it and you're talking to women or girls about birth control and reproductive issues, you are not allowed to mention the word abortion. It's a gag rule. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and he argued in that case, quote, "We continue to believe that Roe was wrongly decided and should be overruled. The court's conclusion in Roe v. Wade that there is a fundamental right to an abortion finds no support in the text, structure, or history of the Constitution." And he won the case, by the way. In another case involving Operation Rescue, he co-authored the government's amicus brief, this is from Salon.com, by the way, supporting the group's right to target clinics under the First Amendment, arguing that Operation Rescue was not engaged in a conspiracy to deny women equal protection under the law. Now, he has said in his confirmation hearing in 2003 that Roe v. Wade is the settled law of the land, but keep in mind, he was saying that as he was going in to become a judge on an appeals court, on a circuit court. So, of course, it's the settled law of the land. The Supreme Court decided it. But now if he's put on the Supreme Court, he has an opportunity to completely change that, right? He can just turn it around. I mean, this is a very scary thing. Not only that, in Hamden versus Rumsfeld, this is the case where a three-judge panel, which included Roberts, he was on the three-judge panel, unanimously ruled for the Bush administration, for Rumsfeld, that George Bush has the right to say, you are an enemy combatant, therefore I decree, George Bush, I decree that you no longer have rights under the U.S. Constitution, and you no longer have rights under the Geneva Conventions. It used to be, if you were caught in war, if you were caught internationally, the Geneva Conventions applied. If you were caught domestically, committing a crime, then civil law, the U.S. Constitution applied. George W. Bush has said, no, neither one. We're going to create a whole new area of law called enemy combatants. It's never before been in the law. We're just going to make it up as we go along. And by the way, you have no rights. We're going to build five concentration camps down in Cuba. They are now building a death camp, a death chamber to go with the sixth concentration camp in Guantanamo Bay. And you have no rights. And this case came before Judge Roberts, and he agreed with George W. Bush. In fact, the lawyer representing Hamdan in the case said this decision is contrary to 200 years of constitutional law. This was Roberts' first major opinion. And by the way, it's probably going to come before the Supreme Court in the next term. Guess what? 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. The folks in the chat room having a lengthy discussion here about Ann Coulter. I would just add to that, I've met her twice, and she has the biggest Adam's apple and the largest hands of any woman I've ever met in my whole entire life. Go figure. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Dale in Kearney, Nebraska on the line. Hey, Dale, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I'm calling to share a story with you that came to my attention just a couple days ago.
Mm-hmm.
I met a lady just by chance that is the grandmother of one of our Iraqi soldiers that was injured.
Mm-hmm.
And this individual is a young girl here in the state of Nebraska. Another girl with her was actually killed, I believe is what the grandmother was telling me. But the lady started getting tears welling up in her eyes as she told me that her and all of the immediate family basically was contacted with regards to them speaking out about the specifics of her granddaughter.
Right.
And basically they were telling these people, silencing them from speaking to anybody.
Right.
And this is coming from the grandmother's mouth to me, but she told me that our Congressman Osborne, they contacted him, and he was able to at least get part of the story in the local press, and mm-hmm. I did see some of that. But, of course, they left out the story about the federal agents contacting the family and telling them not to speak to anybody about it. For me,
this is not all that unusual, Dale.
What they're doing,
the rationale that they're using is they're saying to military families and the families of wounded, they're saying, don't talk about this stuff because you might reveal secrets. You might, you know, troop movements are secret. You might be giving information to the enemy, blah, 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 blah. And really what they're trying to do is they're trying to shut up dissent.
Well, I know that. And what's interesting is this lady looked to me to be somewhere in her early 80s, and she, you could see she truly had fear in her eyes over this situation. And in her and her husband sharing this with immediate friends, basically they told her and her husband they better be quiet because they don't know what might happen. I mean,
you know, that's the Bush administration. They obtain and maintain their pseudo legitimacy by terrorizing people, by terrorizing the American people. It's like, you know, Tom Ridge, after he was no longer Homeland Security czar, going on TV and saying, I didn't authorize all those raising of the alert levels before the election. That came from the White House. It was Karl Rove. Right? He didn't say it was Karl Rove. He said it came from the White House. And he didn't know why it was done. It's because these guys are into terrorizing Americans. And you have to ask yourself, what's the definition of somebody who gets their means accomplished by terrorizing people? I call them terrorists. Yeah, I realize it's inflammatory. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. We got to wrap it up this hour. We'll be back in just a few minutes after the news at the top of the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on the internet, on radiopower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, podcasting on Apple's iTunes. Welcome back to our program. The U.S. Senate Democratic Policy Committee, the DPC, and the U.S. House Government Reform Committee minority will conduct a joint hearing on Friday of this week. This is great. The Senate and House together. Democrats, they couldn't get the Republicans to agree to official hearings, and so the minority members of their committees are going to hold a, by and large, unofficial hearing. The news release, actually, that I have from the Democratic Policy Committee doesn't specify whether it's official or unofficial. My assumption is that it's sort of like John Conyers' hearing recently, that it will be unofficial. Anyhow, the headline, Senate and House Democratic panels to hold oversight hearing on national security consequences of disclosing the identity of a covert intelligence officer. It's going to be 10 o'clock Friday morning in the Dirksen Senate Office Building in Washington, D.C. to examine the national security implications of disclosing the identity of a covert intelligence officer. Hearing will be co-chaired by Senate DPC Chairman Brian Dorgan, Democrat in North Dakota, and U.S. Congressman Henry Waxman, Democrat of California, the ranking member of the House Government Reform Committee. And one of their first witnesses is going to be a fellow who was on this program just a couple of days ago, Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst. Actually, they're going to be a lineup of CIA analysts. Mel Goodman, former senior CIA analyst. David McMichael, former CIA case officer. Jim Markankowski, former CIA case officer. And Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst. So it'll be interesting to see, number one, how much coverage this gets, and number two, what they actually come up with. What are they going to learn from this? At the same time now, folks on progressives in the Democratic Party community are beginning to hold Democrats accountable for their behavior. Shocking concept, absolutely shocking concept, but it's true. It's beginning. The Campaign for America's Future today unveiled an ad that criticizes Congressman John Tanner, Democrat of Tennessee. Now, John Tanner in Tennessee is one of the largest recipients of Walmart money in the United States House of Representatives. And now the Campaign for America's Future is the group that's been doing ads outing House Majority Leader Tom DeLay of Texas, Representative James McCreary, the Republican from Louisiana, for his behavior on the House Social Security Subcommittee, Bob Ney of Ohio, the CoinGate guy, and now the Campaign for America's Future just bought a full-page ad in the largest newspaper in Representative Tanner's district because he voted to give Walmart he voted against an amendment that would have prohibited the Labor Department. Now, this is sort of like a double negative. Here's how it worked out. Walmart was getting nailed for child labor violations and, you know, illegal aliens and all these kinds of things. And so the Bush administration steps in and says, okay, we're going to change the rules. So Walmart has to get a 15-day notification that they're going to be inspected before anybody can go in and check them out. So then the Democrats put forward an amendment to a piece of legislation that would have eliminated that 15-day notice. And this guy This was Representative DeLauro's amendment. And Representative Tanner says, no, of Tennessee, says, I'm going to vote against that, as he's taking money from Walmart. By the way, Walmart's own internal audit disclosed 1,371 violations of child labor laws over a two-year period. They've received hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines for this. Well, they won't anymore. So the ad, this is great, this newspaper ad, Walmart sure knows a bargain when they see one. Take Jackson's Congressman John Tanner. After violating child labor laws, Walmart cut a sweetheart deal with the Bush administration that weakens the government's ability to investigate Walmart stores for future violations. When Congress tried to step in and reverse the deal, Representative Tanner stood with Walmart, not with young workers. How much did his loyalty cost? You could put a price at $17,500, the amount Walmart has contributed to his campaigns. Pocket change for a multi-billion dollar company. It's not supposed to be like this. Representative Tanner was elected to look out for your interests, not those of his corporate lobbyist friends. It's time to remind John Tanner who he really works for. Call his office in Jackson today at 731-423-4848. Isn't this great? The Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, is their website. And, of course, you can also, if you would like to let Congressman Tanner know what you think about what he's been doing, you can also call him toll-free at 1-877-SOB-USOB. SOB, the letter U, SOB. It's the old Senate office building number. It now rings into the Capitol switchboard, and you simply ask for Congressman Tanner or any member of the House or Senate or the White House or the Vice President's office. You can ask for any of them toll-free by simply calling 1-877-SOB-USOB. A lot of these issues growing. Here we have in the face of, at the same time that we have the White House trying to change the subject as quickly as they can to get away from the possibility that George W. Bush or Dick Cheney might have been involved in Treasongate. And I'm convinced that this rapid changing of the subject and the leaking of the phony judge's name yesterday and the whole thing to try and control the news cycle had to do with this getting too close to George Bush rather than just going to Karl Rove. At the same time that that's going on, and now we've got Judge Roberts, let us not forget that there are forces in this country working to devastate the middle class and enrich multinational corporations. That is at the bottom line their agenda. Broadly, we refer to these people as the Bush administration and the Republican Party and a good chunk of the Democratic Party, particularly the DLC faction, the Democratic Leadership Council faction, and something, in my opinion, needs to be done about it. CAFTA, for example. CAFTA was passed by the Senate, which just blew my mind. I mean, my senator here in Oregon, the Democratic senator from Oregon, voted in favor of CAFTA, Ron Wyden. And now it's before the House of Representatives. What's the House of Representatives going to do? What will the consequences of CAFTA be? Beatrice Edwards is with us. She works for Public Services International, an international federation of public workers union based in France. You are based in France?
No, the headquarters of the international is based in France.
Okay.
I'm in Washington.
Okay, makes sense. And and you're also working with the AFL-CIO's Working for America Institute, right?
That's right.
Okay, so tell us what CAFTA is going to mean to us if it gets through the House.
Well, the AFL-CIO has put out a series of reports, as has the International Labor Rights Fund, that shows that if CAFTA is passed as it's negotiated now, it will mean a loss of jobs both here in the United States and in the Central American countries that are the partners to the agreement.
Is that because big multinational corporations will be able to do, as they've done in the United States, as they get larger and larger, consolidate functions?
That's partly it. What will happen is that because U.S. agriculture is subsidized, there'll be a flood of U.S. Agricultural exports to the Central American countries, which will ruin the livelihoods of small farmers there, who are the majority of the population. At the same time, U.S. manufacturing companies will move or can move much of their production and enterprises to the Central American countries, where minimum wage is less than $3.50 a day, and even at that rate is not enforced. So with our agriculture, we eliminate jobs in Central America, and with our industry, we eliminate jobs here in the United States.
So let's just go through the list here, and you can fill some of these blanks in for us. The privatization of public services, how does CAFTA affect that?
Well, CAFTA opens the markets in Central American countries as well as in the United States, but in Central American countries and the Dominican Republic, so that, for example, any multinational corporation that provides healthcare services could bid to become a healthcare provider for the public health system in Honduras or El Salvador, for example.
You mean the government is required to say if Bill Frist's corporation, his father's become one of the richest men in America, multi-billionaire, by buying up previously public hospitals and privatizing them. If Bill Frist's corporation came in and said, we're offering to bid on your, to provide health care services for you in Nicaragua, they would be forced to take that bid and respond to it?
They would be forced to respond to the bid, because under CAFTA, all bidding corporations have to be treated the same way as national enterprises.
And does this work out the way that the NAFTA has and the way that GATT and WTO have to some extent, where if, for example, Bill Frist's family corporation, or what was his family corporation, lost the bid and they could demonstrate that they actually were the lowest bidder, for example, that they could then sue the country and say, hey, somebody else got the profit from this. We should have gotten the profit from this. You have to pay us.
That's exactly what they could do. And the court where they would sue is essentially a corporate-controlled, closed-door court where no public accountability is enforceable.
So similarly, if there's a company in Nicaragua that wants to do business in the United States and they want to come in and say, okay, we're going to bring people in from Nicaragua to do the work, or we're just going to hire folks in the United States, but we're going to pay, you know, X. Now, don't treaties supersede American law? Doesn't this have the potential to destroy our minimum wage laws, for example?
It doesn't immediately. The way this treaty is written is that every country is obliged to respect its own labor, its existing labor laws.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is for Central American countries, the existing labor laws are very weak, and there is nothing to ensure that the laws as they stand can't be further weakened. And in fact, there are moves to weaken them further. As privatization moves through the public sector, the protections for wages for public sector workers are being eliminated.
Oh, yeah. We've seen the Bush administration doing that here.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, 3 years ago, Bush came right out and said he was going to try and take 800,000 U.S. Federal employees and convert them to private employees and get rid of the union.
And that's exactly what he is proceeding to do.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, it was a big part of the Homeland Security thing, that part of that debate. So, Beatrice, where can people find out more information about this, Beatrice Edwards?
Well, on the AFL website, it's www.aflcio.org. There is a document put out by John Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO, also a blog called Kill CAFTA by Greg Spotts, and that should give you a number of links to other sources of information about CAFTA.
All that stuff at aflcio.org.
That's great. Right.
Beatrice Edwards, thanks so much for being with us today. For America Institute. Keep up the good work and spreading the good word. Much appreciated. 20 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartmann radio program, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved.
Ah, the old labor song.
That stands by the water. We shall not be moved.
Well, unless CAFTA comes along, then. Yeah, then we got a problem. But it looks like, you know, from everything I'm hearing, there are not the votes in the House of Representatives to pass CAFTA, which makes you wonder, you know, how out of touch are the senators with this thing? But we'll see. I mean, the lobbying hasn't finished. The passing out of dollars has not completed itself. We'll see. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst, wrote the following letter to Dennis Hastert, Nancy Pelosi, Bill Frist, and Harry Reid, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Minority Leader of the House, the Majority Leader of the House, and the Minority Leader of the Senate, about the media coverage of Valerie Plame, Valerie Wilson, and her being outed. He says, we, the undersigned former U.S. intelligence officers, and there's a bunch of them who signed this letter, are concerned with the tone and substance of the public debate over the ongoing Department of Justice investigation into who leaked the name of Valerie Plame. What he's talking about here is the incredible spin that has been put on this thing by the White House and the Rove machine, trying to minimize what happened and what the consequences of it. It's the equivalent of some Democrats back when Clinton was president saying, hey, it's just, you know, private consensual sex. These guys are trying to say, well, hey, it's just a CIA agent, you know. Well, here, he points out the intelligence officials. They say the disclosure of Mrs. Plame's name was a shameful event in American history, and in our professional judgment may have damaged U.S. national security and poses a threat to the ability of U.S. intelligence agencies gathering information using human sources. Any breach of the code of confidentiality and cover weakens the overall fabric of intelligence and directly or indirectly jeopardizes the work and safety of intelligence workers and their sources. He says, as part of this campaign, he's talking about the Republican National Committee has circulated talking points to supporters. Now, this is a letter from CIA agents, former CIA agents. The Republican National Committee has circulated talking points to supporters to use as part of a coordinated strategy to discredit Ambassador Joseph Wilson and his wife. As part of this campaign, a common theme is the idea that Ambassador Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, was not undercover and deserved no protection. The following are four recent examples of this talking point. Number one, on Larry King Live on July 12, 2005, right-wing talk show host Michael Medved said, quote, and let's be honest about this, Mrs. Plame, Mrs. Wilson, had a desk job at Langley. She went back and forth every single day, end quote. Victoria Tenzik stated on a Fox News program with John Gibson on June 12, 2005, quote, well, they weren't taking affirmative measures to protect that identity. They gave her a desk job in Langley. You don't really have somebody go deep undercover going back and forth to Langley where people can see them, end quote. Ed Rogers, former Washington lobbyist and former Republican official, said on July 13th, the next day on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, quote, and also I think it's now a matter of established fact that Mrs. Plame was not a protected covert agent, and I don't think there's any meaningful investigation about that, end quote. And then you even have a member of Congress, Ray Blunt, Republican of Missouri, on Face the Nation, July 17th, again quoting the Republican talking points. He says, quote, it certainly wouldn't be the first time that the CIA might have been overzealous in sort of maintaining the kind of top secret definition on things longer than they needed to. You know, this was a job that the ambassador's wife had that she went to every day. It was a desk job. I think many people in Washington understood that her employment was at the CIA and that she went to that office every day, end of quote. Then the former intelligence officials say, these comments reveal an astonishing ignorance, of the intelligence community and the role of cover. The fact is that there are thousands of U.S. intelligence officers who, quote, work at a desk, end quote, in the Washington, D.C. area every day and who are undercover. Intelligence officers should not be used as political footballs. In the case of Valerie Plame, she still works for the CIA and is not in a position to publicly defend her reputation and her honor. We stand in her stead. For the good of the country, please stand up for every man and woman who works for the U.S. intelligence community and help protect their ability to live their cover. Sincerely, and a whole bunch of CIA analysts here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website if you want to drop in. I'm telling you, this thing, this whole mess, this whole Treasongate mess is, in my opinion, going to end up at the desk of George W. Bush if the media will stay on it. And if they go along with the attempts to obfuscate and change the topic, then, you know, democracy is lost. I mean, yesterday, it was just such a brilliant example of this. Yesterday morning, the story comes out that a memo saying Valerie Plame's identity is secret. She's Joe Wilson's wife. She works for the CIA. This the same day, July 7, 2003, that Joe Wilson publishes his piece in the New York Times. A memo prepared by the State Department is sent to Air Force One. Now, you know what Air Force One is. That's George W. Bush's private plane, right? It's George Bush and Colin Powell and Ari Fleischer are on Air Force One flying to Africa. This memo is sent to Air Force One. Hours later, Karl Rove and Scott Scooter Libby start dialing for dollars, calling reporters and saying, hey, did you know? Now, the memo said, don't leak this information. And Rove and Libby both signed forms, you know, government employee forms, saying that because they had security clearances, that they could lose their security clearance if they leaked secure information. Not to mention the fact that this might be treason. Thus, Treasongate. You know, it surprises me, frankly, how few people are calling this Treasongate. Because it is. Anyhow, so, you know, here's this situation. And so what, as soon as the story comes out, I mean, you know, it breaks yesterday morning. It's a relatively small AP story, but everybody knows in Washington, D.C., and reporters get a hold of this thing, and now it's moving from, is it Karl Rove, to, is it Karl Rove and Scooter Libby, to, is it Karl Rove, Scooter Libby, and George W. Bush, and Dick Cheney. And that's that John Dean moment that I referred to earlier, where when the House and Senate were investigating the Watergate burglary, and they all thought that it was just G. Gordon Liddy and his merry band, and they're calling before, they get Haldeman up there, and he dissembles, and they get Ehrlichman up there, and he lies to them. And these guys went to jail for lying to Congress. And then they get John Dean up there, and John Dean is Richard Nixon's private lawyer. Or not private lawyer, he's the House counsel. He's what Alberto Gonzalez was to George W. Bush. And John Dean testifies honestly and says, no, I discussed this with Richard Nixon, with the president. I told him that, sir, there's a cancer on the presidency. He was referring to John Mitchell and his involvement and Haldeman and Ehrlichman's involvement with Watergate. And in that discussion, John Dean figures out that Nixon knew about this all along. And that's the moment when everything changes. And all of a sudden, it's not about what's going on inside the Nixon administration. Now it's about how long before we impeach Richard Nixon for high crimes and misdemeanors. Which is why Nixon resigned, because he was certainly going to be impeached. So here, yesterday, the Bush administration facing a John Dean moment. A document being released that might take this all the way to Dick Cheney and George Bush. And what do? 9 o'clock in the morning, George Bush decides on who he's going to nominate for the Supreme Court. He's getting frantic now. At 11 o'clock, he calls up Judge Roberts and says, will you do this? Judge says yes. He says, okay, cool. Come on over for dinner tonight. We're going to make an announcement. And then the White House leaks the name of somebody else altogether. So, you know, all the press, all the pontificators, all the commentators, everybody is talking about, you know, the various Ediths, right? It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. Toss some red meat to the press and give them the wrong red meat, because what that means is there's going to be all this pontification, all this research up until 5, 6 o'clock in the evening Eastern time, and then at 6, 7, 8 o'clock Eastern time, when the real name comes out, the press has to do it all over again. We're going to keep them really busy so they can't pay any attention at all to this memo. One 888 9 8 9 4 telephone number. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Roy, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. Let me correct something that you were just saying. That that story actually broke on Saturday.
The original story that dragged. Oh,
right.
About the memo going to the what,
right,
Air Force
and Air? I was absolutely amazed that it wasn't covered on the Talking Head shows on Sunday morning.
I'm amazed I missed it.
And then it showed up a little bit on Sunday, and then it showed up again on Monday, and it was kind of like they were just regurgitating the same story. But anyway,
yeah. That's the story that they've got to cover up. That's the story that they've got to hide, regardless of when it came out.
And I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. On that, I just in the last half hour I checked Buzzflash, and it turns out that our new Supreme Court nominee's wife is very invested in some satellite TV conglomerate thing that is working to get the concession for Iraq.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not cognizant of that. I don't know enough about it to really talk about it because I just glanced at the headlines and was like, oh, man, is this fascism or what?
Yeah.
A couple of the other things that I did want to point out, though, that with them keeping the news folks off balance yesterday, they also kept the Dems off balance so that they couldn't prepare their response for when the name was finally linked. And then secondly, for the last week or 10 days, they have been setting the frame up that we have to be reasonable and we have to be fair and we have to be polite and we have to give them a fair hearing. And so the tone last night with the Dems, nobody came out. Number one, they didn't even know where the bullets were to put it in the gun to be ready to shoot.
Yeah. It was
so they were just sitting there saying, I got this gun here, but I think I'm going to give you a break. You know?
It was a brilliant strategy, strategy.
One of the other frames that they keep talking about is his whole judicial qualifications, which are brilliant. I mean, the man obviously is a brilliant man. You don't graduate cumma sum laude being a fool.
Yeah, in 3 years.
And then when they talk about his response that he wouldn't do anything about Roe v. Wade because, you know, he couldn't do anything about it anyway. Kind of reminds me back in the 50s in Oklahoma. I think his name was Edmondson. He was running for governor, and they kept trying to back him in the corner. How do you feel about the state going wet? How do you feel about this prohibition? And he was saying, well, look, it's in the Constitution. As a governor, I can't do anything to change the Constitution. He was elected and immediately threw up roadblocks at every road coming into the state.
Right.
Dried the state up. The moonshiners and the bootleggers were funneling money to the preachers to defeat the constitutional amendment. They lost. The state went wet. Now, Edmondson had no power to change the Constitution. But all he did was make it so uncomfortable that everybody else wanted to change it.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
It's kind of the same thing. When he sits there and says, well, I couldn't do anything about that. Well, yeah, that was then.
Yeah.
This becomes now.
And yeah, good point, Roy. And thank you for calling and making it. That's very much what what's going on here with Roberts saying in 2003 when he was confirmed. That, well, you know, Roe v. Wade is settled law. Well, yeah, as a district court judge or as a circuit court judge, it is settled law, and you've got to deal with that. Right? But as a Supreme Court judge, it's not settled law. Because nothing is settled until the Supreme Court says it. This is, while you were talking, I found the story here. His wife is big in satellite systems, our new Supreme Court nominee. Her company is targeting Iraq. That's fascinating. This is in the Margie Burns blog, margieburns.com. She says, yet another first for our boundary-breaching White House. For the first time in American history, we're going to have a justice in the High Court whose spouse facilitates financing and putting together global satellite systems. Also, the company in which she's a partner. By the way, John Roberts, made $1 million a year as a silk stocking lawyer with the Washington, D.C. law firm. The Washington, D.C. law firm, by the way, that participated in arguing the Bush v. Gore case before the Supreme Court that put George Bush into the White House in the first place. The company in which his wife is a partner, Shaw Pittman, emphasizes, among other things, its expertise in facilitating business in Iraq. This from their website, quote, "We offer one-stop service to clients pursuing projects in Iraq. From solicitation and RFP counseling, that's requests for proposals, to working with key government and multilateral agencies, and from initially penetrating the Iraqi marketplace to final project implementation. Our attorneys are recognized as leaders in their fields and at the cutting edge of a variety of disciplines relevant to Iraq reconstruction. A number have served in senior government positions in key agencies, including the Departments of Transportation, Navy, Justice, and Commerce, as well as the Agency for International Development and the World Bank." End of quote. Yeah. Ms. Roberts, according to her company bio, Ms. Roberts practices with the firm's communications and global sourcing groups, concentrating on representing clients in sophisticated transactions involving technology. She has extensive experience in representing clients in the buying and selling of space-related goods and services, including companies involved in the development of multi-billion-dollar global and regional satellite systems. Ms. Roberts' experience also includes representing clients in information technology outsourcing transactions, software licensing, development, maintenance contracts, and professional service arrangements. Prior to 1992, she practiced litigation in a wide variety of matters before various courts and decision-making bodies, including large international commerce arbitration involving nuclear power plants before the International Chamber of Commerce. And says Maggie Burns, shades of Homer Simpson. Oh, my goodness. This is just absolutely... Now, see, this was the thing. The Wall Street Journal was lobbying. You know, they've been... big business has had their hand in this thing for a while. And the Wall Street Journal was lobbying pretty overtly, actually, in their pages. And not so much in the editorial pages, oddly enough, but in the news pages. Was lobbying for a business-friendly judge. And what they pointed out, and I shared several of these stories with you over the course of the last 3 or 4 weeks as they've come out from the Wall Street Journal, what they were saying basically was that several of the members of the current Supreme Court who are anti-abortion, like Clarence Thomas and Anthony Scalia, concern the business community because they are constantly talking about states' rights. And they're a little concerned about this, if the Supreme Court says, no, it's up to the states, well, the states, different states will have different standards for doing business as well as for abortion. See, the states' rights argument is that it's none of the federal business's, government's business whether abortion is legal or whether it's illegal. That's really up to the individual states. That's the argument that Scalia and Thomas make. So they would roll back Roe v. Wade, but they wouldn't criminalize abortion. They would simply say a state can do that if they want to. It's a states' rights issue. Now, the problem with that logic from the Wall Street Journal's point of view is that if you extend that logic, that means that a state can make up their own mind and make up their own decision about whether or not they're going to protect endangered species, whether or not they're going to defend local communities against predatory corporations, whether or not they're going to have tighter or looser standards for pollution, what their auto mileage standards might be, and on and on and on. And none of these things are, you know, all of these things are probably just fine for small and medium-sized businesses, but for the really big multi-state corporations who represent a large chunk of the constituents of the Wall Street Journal, and certainly the investors in Dow Jones, these things are anathema. This is terrible. This would be a disaster. They want to be able to, you know, do one-stop shopping and go to Washington, D.C. and just bribe, you know, 100 members of the Senate and a couple hundred members of the House of Representatives and have it over with. Just pay off the president and vice president. That's it. So the Wall Street Journal has been saying, you know, let's not have an anti-abortion candidate come forward because the anti-abortion candidate may end up being an anti-business candidate as well, because the logic that they'll use to knock down the abortion laws or the knock down Roe v. Wade is that once that logic is out there in play, that logic will work to the detriment of business. And they were correctly pointing out that several of the candidates the White House was looking at who were openly anti-abortion were using the states' rights arguments to justify that. And therefore, they were not necessarily totally pro-business. And then there's, so you've got the business faction, you've got the abortion faction, and then there's the third faction, and that's the Gonzalez, Bush, Rumsfeld, Cheney fascist faction, who want to see the elimination of civil rights and human rights in the United States and around the world. And they want to take us into a Pinochet-like world where American citizens can simply be disappeared. Like Jose Padilla. Yesterday, his lawyer went into court and said, please indict my client. Why? Because you can't have a trial until there's an indictment. This guy's been in jail for a couple of years. What was his crime? He surfed the internet and looked at a website on how to build a dirty bomb. And they, well, at least that's is suggested as his crime. There has been no indictment. The guy is being held in jail clearly illegally. He's a U.S. citizen. He was arrested on U.S. territory. So you've got the fascist crowd, you've got the corporatist crowd, and you've got the anti-abortion crowd. And with John Roberts, George W. Bush got a threefer. And the Wall Street Journal is ecstatic. The corporatists are ecstatic. The fascists are ecstatic, and the anti-abortion folks are ecstatic, and the only people who are going to really be screwed by this and really lose are the citizens of the United States and the world. And, you know, a few endangered species and people who value their health and their welfare and their life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These quaint concepts, to paraphrase, and to Mr. Gonzalez. Very quaint. Just, you know, it's just human rights, right? You know, 12-year-old girl, she ate a French fry. Yeah, but she shouldn't eat that French fry. Throw her in a slammer. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Adlai Stevenson in 1956, a speech written by John Kenneth Galbraith, according to Tom in Minnesota. He emailed this to me. He says, Adlai Stevenson said in 1956, his speech, you roll back the stones and you find slithering things. That is the world of Richard Nixon. Yes, yes, well said. And that is the world of George W. Bush. Increasingly, this is the direction we're moving, and it's just why possibly Bush? Why now? Possibly George Bush authorized either explicitly or implicitly the leak to retaliate against Joe Wilson. This is my take on this thing. And, you know, there's some speculation out there about this, and I think that you're going to see more and more and more. In fact, in the Boston Globe here, this piece, nothing in the Bush administration happens by accident. Right. Well said. I agree. Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, what's up? I have just two questions. First is, if the Valerie Plame thing isn't a crime, then why is it a revenge? How is it revenge? I mean, if it's not a crime, then why was outing it some style of vindictive act? And then the second question is there actually an ID legislation that has passed that has requiring everyone to have IDs?
Yeah, the Real ID bill. Yeah, the Real ID was attached to the, I believe it was the budget bill. And yes, it has passed and it's gone to the president. And it's going to mean that within, I think it's a 5-year period. I'd have to go back and dig out the details on it. But within a few years, everyone is going to have all the state's driver's licenses are going to have biometric data. And they can be, they can use RFID chips so that as you walk down the street, you can be scanned. If you show up in a protest, you can be scanned. As you walk into a store, you can be scanned. And they'll know not just your name, your social security number, your address, your unique identifier, your fingerprint, your DNA, I mean, whatever. It's all going to be there. Yeah.
And you'll be required to carry it.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the whole point of it. Yep.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call, Logan. This is something, I mean, very few of us were really talking about the Real ID Act. And oddly, you had folks who generally are, you know, relatively civil libertarians like Lou Dobbs just pushing the thing because he thought it was the solution to illegal immigration. And, of course, it's not. The solution to illegal immigration is to solve the insane economic policies that are encouraging illegal immigrants to come into the United States. Roll us back to pre-Reagan and, you know, bring back the labor unions, and you'll see the end of illegal immigration. But that's just too obvious, apparently, for this bunch. Thanks to Scott for engineering our program today, to Louise for producing it. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Have a great day. Spread the word. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.